That's a Knisket Sakra and Armaj herbal. As once you get that adrenaline level, it's really an easy night.
I think my best night was my first night. I should play a mech of precise in the good world.
U meta nara din l-imħabba ħnajdu hekk u din l-enerġija kollha tan-nisflimkien naħseb il-karriera tiegħi tissodisfani ħafna f'dan l-ispett.
Din varjetà hija importanti ħafna. Għolot il-varieta għat-turisti li għabu ħat ħajdera. Mekka tamme l-istess ħagġad bulħat, noħsin nis mux ħajdurek.
I think it's been very successful. Kajer, konna dija monesti, għad-dibna ħat-tadis.
I mean, who wouldn't choose a lifestyle of being paid to play music, of having a free bar tariff and being paid to make people have fun and being part of that fun yourself? I mean, who wouldn't want a job like that?
Kikum makinu jizmin zbieħ, grandiuzi, gloriuzi. Kikullum maħnix bil-qeda unek edin nitkelmu. Fuq il-passat tagħna.
Campus FM jippreżenta għalfejn il-lejla ħars allura lejn l-era ta' twelid u tkattir ta' diskoteki f'pajjiżna, kif ukoll ta' Paċifil bħala l-kapitali ta' xena ta' divertiment ta' bil-lejl. Produzzjoni u preżentazzjoni tiegħi Colin Fitz.
Merba l-episodju numru 10 mis-sensila għalfejn il-lejla fuq 103.7 Campus FM miħaj Colin Fitz. Il-lum se nitkellem ma' Ian James, personalità assoċjata ma' diskoteki Stones f'Buġibba kif ukoll Sticks fil-Bajja ta' San George u eventualment fit-tmexxija ta' l-Axis f'Paċifil. Se nisema' perspettiva differenti tal-ħajja ta' bil-lejl f'pajjiżna fis-snin 80 u 90 minn personalità Ingliża li kien ġie hawnhekk biex jibda bħala DJ u tekniku tal-apparat tad-diskoteki imma spiċċa biex baqa' hawnhekk iż-żewweġ u issa fil-fatt huwa irtirat u jgħix f'pajjiżna. Ian James fuq għalfejn il-lejla. Ian James came to Malta in 1981 as part of the team at Styx. Am I correct in that?
Pretty much. I mean, basically, Styx, they already had a foreign DJ who'd been there about a month and a half before I came to Malta. His name was David Hensel. And he was actually DJing out of what was the original Styx, or Styx 1. I was brought here predominantly to oversee the final setups for Stones in Buġibba. I came over at the end of October in 1981, and as I said, I was there to make sure that all the electricals went in, that all the control systems operated, and in fact I ended up having to design control panels because a lot of the technology that Kevin had brought for the club didn't exist anywhere else, and they didn't have the control systems for it, so I made some bespoke controllers and so on, so that everything worked. In the UK, when I left university, I was in human relations, H&R, for oil companies, in based in the north end of London. Through a pure quirk of fate, I ended up becoming a part-time DJ, which in turn took over my entire life and became a full-time DJ and worked quite a lot internationally and for a lot of big places in London in particular. Let me see, the London Playboy Club, I was the resident DJ there for nearly 2 years. I also used to work the Bells on King's Road, which was the original big disco pub in London, where we used to have Chelsea football teams and everybody else used to be in there on a regular basis. I worked in Barcelona, I worked at a place called the Charlie Max, which was the club for Barcelona FC. It was owned by the same directors who owned Barcelona, so obviously, as you can appreciate, it's a very jet-set place. So, I mean, I DJed a lot. At the time, when I first considered coming to Malta, I'd just come back from America. I'd been working in Los Angeles for a while, and I was working in Birmingham at a big new club up there. And the main reason I ended up coming to Malta in the first place was literally going through a magazine, and DJ International or whatever it was called in those days, and seeing an advert that they were looking for a commissioning engineer stroke DJ to launch a new project in Malta. It was scheduled to be 3 months, and I thought, well, 3 months out of a British winter would be rather nice, and lo and behold, I ended up in Malta.
And never went back?
I never went back.
mention a few the VIPs and celebrities that you met in this career. You must have met some important people.
Well, yeah, quite a lot. I mean, in London times, I mean, I used to be the tame DJ, for want of a better word, for CBS Records out of Soho. And I used to do their yearly get-togethers, which meant I worked with a lot of their big stars. I mean, how would you begin? Icy Brothers, Ted Nugent, if you want to go across the spectrum from soul, whatever. I also did work at, La Valbonne, which was Louis Brown's club in Soho, which was the place to be. I mean, it was the one which had all the gorgeous waitresses everywhere, the swimming pool in the middle of the dance floor where all the girls used to dance, let's say semi-naked, and just about any celebrity that was in town used to be there. So, I mean, lots of places and lots of things before I came to Malta, which were...
And obviously lots of footballers.
Yeah. Obviously, I mean, those were the good old times. So when Chelsea was a good team, as a Man United supporter,
and then Barcelona as well. I mean,
yes, I was here at Barcelona again. I mean, I was in Barcelona for just 3 months. I went over there. They did a refurbishment at a particular club. As I say, it's called the Charlie Max, just off the Calle Sotelo, in that part of Barcelona, and they wanted a DJ that was doing the London soul style, which is what I'd been doing at La Valbonne. And in fact, they'd actually come to La Valbonne and sort of said to me, name your contract, come with us, we want you to be our soul DJ so we can open the club in this style. And so I had a nice 3 months there.
So, yes, this leads me to my next question. What kind of music was played in clubs in London and the places you DJed in that era? Or was it like separate clubs with separate types of music?
Well, basically, I mean, I worked in clubs that were dealing with a broad spectrum of people, but within a certain age group, I mean, i.e. it was all people with money. So it tended to be people late 20s, 30s and upwards. And so their taste would not be the most de rigueur latest trend. It would be more the sort of music that they'd grown up with. So a lot of the clubs I worked, it was what a lot of people would call pop, soul, Motown, this style of thing. It wasn't until I actually went up to work out of Birmingham that I got more into music like New Romantics and things like that, which I brought to Malta and which had never really been heard in Malta. When I first started playing New Romantic style music here, a lot of people were like, what's that, you know? But then when they realized how you could mix it and jiggle it and really make it danceable, it became very, very popular.
That was the era of the famous Blitz Club in London, down in King's Road or wherever that was.
Well, as I said, at that time, though, of the New Romantics, I was working more up in Birmingham. So I was working with Soft Cell, with Duran Duran and people like that. And in fact, in the apartment building that I lived, we actually had two members of Duran Duran living in the same apartment block. So it was like a very, but they weren't that famous at that time.
No.
So, you know, it was all like a big gaggle of people together.
And disco music, surely.
Yes, of course. I mean,
that came out of soul, didn't it?
Everything came out of soul in those days. I mean, to my mind, disco was disco until we got to acid and acid house. That was the real major break away from the original soul scene. I mean, before you had soul, or you had rock, or you had the New Romantic style, which was the crossover between, because it's electronic. It was only when acid house and everything became super repetitious, and we had to keep scratching the records to get single lyric out, you know, acid, and all this sort of thing going on, that's when the music really changed away to where it is today.
But don't you
So you come to Malta for those 3 months, you thought, to for this new project. Had you been to Malta before?
I had been evacuated to Malta as a baby of 2 years old, many, many years ago, because my father was in the Air Force, we were in Jordan, and they flew us all to Malta as a staging point to get us back to England when there were troubles. That's the only thing I knew about Malta. So basically I knew next to nothing what I was putting my head into, but it just sounded like a good challenge. Okay. And as I said, initially I came here for October, November, December to go back in January time, and that was to get Stones up and running, which we actually opened at the beginning of, or middle of December of 1981, and we got it up, got it started, got it running, and I was told, if you want you can get an extra month out of this, and I said, well, yeah, I'm enjoying it now, I've got the baby going, I want to see it born and flourish, you know, we'll probably only open Stones on the Friday, Saturdays for the time being, because it's winter time. And I said, well, fine, and you'll work at what was the old original Styx One underneath Eden Beach Hotel on a couple of the other days.
Because it was owned by the same people.
Exactly, De Cesare. The theme was, we opened Stones properly just before Christmas, for Christmas Eve. I remember that there was a queue all the way down Pioneer Road waiting to get in, and it was at a situation where, I mean, Stones had a capacity maybe 750, 800 people. We were at maximum capacity the entire time, and it was like two in, two out, and working this way. And far from being a situation where we just were going to work Stones in Bujibba for the weekends and probably all the rest of the work would be at Styx, we didn't close Stones for a single day for about 1.5 years thereafter. It was packed every night. And it was amazing because, I mean, people in those days, we've told them, there's a dress code, you know, you've got to be smart to get in. And everybody came dressed smart. And, you know, it was like unheard of that a club could sort of operate in that manner. But we did.
So, was there a massive difference? Was it like, oh my God, where have I come to? From the jet set of London and America and Barcelona to Malta. It was still a very conservative country with not a massive nightlife scene. Or am I mistaken?
Well, the potential was there. It just, nothing had been really opened in Malta that could really take that potential and build it. I mean, Stones was good because it was different. I mean, it was there in the basement, fully air conditioned, shut off from the world, and people could literally just go there, and it was a unique atmosphere for them. But I mean, it was really the forerunner of all the bigger clubs that were to follow, like the 6-2, etc., because it was a place where people could come together, a unique atmosphere, you were able to run a door policy. I mean, there were others all the way around. I mean, there was JJ's and others, and what's her name, where Albert used to be,
Dewdrops
and so on. I mean, there were other clubs around, but none of them quite had that niche that we were able to make out of Stones. And, in turn, transfer it to the new Styx 2 when we opened Styx 2, eventually Euphoria, and so on. It was always a case of having to be slightly ahead of the curve, both in the technology you used, the music you used, and to generate this buzz for the people that it's somewhere you had to be on your Friday night or Saturday night or whatever.
So you didn't feel like an alien coming to Malta, it was just another project for you? Or were there any sort of culture shocks for you?
Oh yeah, there were quite a few culture shocks. I remember the first night I arrived in Malta, I was taken into what was the original Styx, which was like the extended garage down underneath the hotel, and met David and a few other people. I played a couple of records there, and I remember some people coming up to me, oh, I haven't seen you before as a DJ. Yeah, I'm going to be the DJ at Stones for a while when we launch it, blah, blah. I seemed to make friends out of nowhere, which was quite unknown, because in London, people had to know you like 5 months before they said hello. And that particular night, I was told, I was invited by some of these new people that I'd met, would you like to come for cheesecakes? And I'm thinking, yeah, I could really fancy some cheesecake. I like cheesecake and coffee. Yeah, we're going to a place called the Palace, Crystal Palace. Oh, that sounds quite fancy. Yeah, yeah, I'll go. Anyway, I come out and there's this broken down long wheelbase Land Rover, which belonged to the guy, it was Anton St. John, who used to run the water sports in Malia. And we all piled into this thing, about nine of us, and we're bumbling all the way through these back roads, which I didn't know. And then I'm suddenly thinking, hey, I'm wearing a like an ankle thing with all the money in the world I owe in Malta, in the back of a truck with people I've known for 5 minutes, going God knows where. But as it happened, we arrived at Crystal Palace, and they said, don't worry, stay in the truck, we'll get you some cheesecake. Do you want cheesecake and tea or a coffee? I said, a tea would be nice, you know. And he comes back with this paper packet. I go, what's this? And I opened it, and there's this flaky thing in it. I said, well, no, I ordered cheesecake. Yeah, that's cheesecake in Malta. Da. All right, my first culture shock, what Maltese cheesecake actually is, which has drawn out a long living lifetime of enjoying cheesecake, hence my waistline.
So you like
oh yeah, I like my cheesecake.
Was there a difference, for example, in the kind of music you played when you were abroad, when you were in London, America, whatever, or did you bring your style to Malta, or did you have to adapt to a style that was played here?
Well, basically, I mean, I had the chance to listen to what was being played. Obviously, when I came to Malta, I brought a large record collection with me. I used to have three large flight cases for the 12 inches and albums and so on, and two semi-flight cases for 7-inch singles. So I brought probably 1,300-1,400 records with me when I came here, because I honestly didn't know what I was stepping into. But I brought a very broad cross-section of all the styles that I'd played anywhere else in the world. Obviously, I went to do drops. I listened to what Albert was playing. I listened to what David was playing at the Sticks and so on. And I decided, right, well, that's what they're doing. I can do that. I've got all that. What have I got that nobody else is playing? Which was, in fact, pretty much the New Romantics and the first things of being able to mix records and get bends and blends and so on. So, you know, like, just can't get enough or something like that, and blending, get enough and all this stuff. And people are like, what's he doing with the record? And playing two records of the same and getting it to verve. As you know, you can get an echo verve if you just pull them slightly. And people are like, how do you do that? And it was good because people would like come and just be transfixed.
So OMD, Blancmange, that kind of music, mm-hmm, with a bit of a beat,
sort of influenced by more order. And then here I was introduced to the Italian styles, so Vamos alla Playa or whatever, and Boys, and all these sort of things, you know, the real cheesy but fun Europe music that came from Europe. So it then became being able to blend and play everything for everybody. But I mean, my style was to try and play stuff in ways that nobody else was doing.
And it went down well?
Yeah, because I mean, I would like get out, say, an 8-record set of Motown, and I would literally just play slip bits from each record and keep changing them across and making my own sound, my own records from them. And people like got fascinated, how do you do that, you know? And it was fun, because it was a teaser, nobody else was doing it, so it helped a lot. Obviously now everybody does it, because it's all done with CDs and MP3s and you name it, and anybody can be a DJ and twiddle a knob for 5 minutes and look good. But in those days we had to do it all live and with running turntables.
Do you remember the first song played at Stones, or one of the first songs perhaps? Mm. It was a very successful night, you said.
Oh yeah.
Huge queue. First few record, one of the first.
I honestly...
Was it Tainted Love, maybe, or Don't You Want Me Baby, or what? No, but that would have been sort of the...
No, Don't You Want Me Baby, I mean, I used to do that mix running in the three versions
that
of it
was
at the
later.
Same time.
Oh, wow. But as you said, that came from your mix. It probably wasn't so big in Malta yet.
I honestly can't remember what the first record would be, because I mean, literally right up until the moment the doors were opening, we were still wiring, soldering, cleaning, getting things together. So I would say the first hour or so was a total blur in there anyway. So no, I'm afraid I can't tell you what the first record ever was played in Malta at that club. We brought a lot of new things there. I mean, for instance, we introduced the disco dance competition. I managed to get Malibu on board with that. We did the Malibu disco dancing contest. And we actually sent a representative from Malta to Turkey, Roger Muscat and Jesmond, his best friend. They took part, and we managed to get them through onto the international dancing scene.
Was it like still the sort of Saturday Night Fever style dancing?
It was that and a lot of spinning on the floor and acrobatics.
So the beginning of the raps.
The breakdance.
Breakdance, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Okay, so...
With Malibu then, uh-huh. We then progressed from that because we couldn't just do a dance contest, they wanted constant exposure. So we used to do the beach parties.
The legendary beach parties, we'll get the to legend. Them, yes, yes. What made you decide to stay after your third and your fourth 4 months in Malta, which was your original plan? Then you decided to stay and now you're Maltese now.
Yeah, I mean, the situation was that it was kept, stay, don't go, we need you, we want, whatever.
Boss,
so it kept on going on. And then suddenly it was a case of like, we better get you your work permit sorted out. And when the work permit came, obviously, it meant that I would then be finishing just before summer. And I said, well, look, I don't want that. Can you get me a full work permit for a full year so I can stay through? Because having worked all the way through the winter, there was no way I was going to miss a summer in Malta. And that happened. And thereafter, always like tied up that the work permits were always coming due just before summer. So every year it was the same thing. Well, hell, I'm not going back to the UK if I can have another summer in Malta. So
were your family or friends back home? Did they understand? Did they come and visit?
Well, I don't have any brothers and sisters. I was an only child. My mother and father were quite used to me always being away somewhere. And at one stage I brought a girlfriend of mine from that time in the UK to Malta. And she spent quite a period of time with me here, but eventually the Maltese situation didn't suit her, so she went back. But I mean, so the start of it was all very much a case of nobody's going to miss me, let's just have a good time.
And so, and you were comfortable, your pay was good, you felt like you were living, for example, was...
By Maltese standards, yeah. I mean, I used to live at the Eden Beach Hotel. I had my own, a very nice big double bedroom there at the hotel. I had a company car, which was a hire car from Auto Rentals, which is Jay Joy's dad. I had more than enough salary. By Maltese standards, I was paid very well. By UK standards and what I'd been earning abroad, it was pretty rubbish, but then I had no expenses. So, I mean, everything sort of was just a very easy, casual life, and it was nice. I was about 27, 28 when I came to Malta.
Was the, at that age, you know, boy meets girl, enjoying the nightlife, maybe dating, was it a nice life? We were perhaps adventure, romance?
Am I allowed to comment on such things? I'm a married man now.
It's an ancient history.
Yeah, well, I mean, rather than talking about my own personal situation, I mean, the one thing that really caught my eye here in Malta was when summer came round. Now, I had been operating at Stones through the winter, through Easter, whatever, and a lot of the Maltese lads had their Maltese girlfriends and so on, and sort of by midnight latest they'd be taking the girlfriends home and so forth. And then suddenly I started seeing a culture change, which was that the girlfriends started, as we got into summer, the girlfriends got taken home a little bit earlier. And then the lads would come back, because then the foreign tourists would be in there, and they'd have a tourist girlfriend from sort of midnight onwards, and the Maltese girlfriend up until 10:30 at night, you know. I'm thinking, this is crazy. You know, but that was the way things seemed to be. And then come September, October time, the Maltese girlfriends were back, and everything was back to life as normal.
Did you have any liaisons with locals?
Of course.
What was being a DJ quite a, not prestigious, but sort of cool thing to be? I would assume so.
Oh yeah, there's definitely an element of celebrity in being like really the only foreign or major foreign DJ on the island at the time. I mean, I was able to live that lifeline for, maybe about 5 to 6 years of being the only DJ of any note on the island who was foreign as well. Then obviously Graham and a few others came down and, it spread out and around.
I just can't get enough. We're so in love.
What was the British tourism like?
Well, British tourism was very strong. I mean, yes, there were a lot of Brits in the Pachipa area, and anybody asking where to go was directed towards Stones. But that said, it wasn't just Pachipa. I mean, people came from all over the island to be at Stones. That car park and the front of Pioneer Road and so on was always jammed solid with people. And then, of course, all the Italians coming down, and then the two would mix, and you'd get a really, you know, ethnic mix of music to go to suit both crowds. The Maltese had the music they liked, the British were liking their style, and then the Italians, as I said, brought in the Italian music, and that's how I learnt to get more involved with Italian music. I mean, but the beautiful thing about it was there was good integration. Everybody got on with everybody else. The Maltese boys chased the British girls. The British girls wanted the Italian boys. The Italian boys were so busy preening themselves they didn't care what was going on, you know.
And some Swedes eventually, there was a Swedish language school, wasn't there?
Well, I mean, one thing I always used to remember at Stones was in the height of summer, which the when we used to finish and finally close the doors.
What time would that have been?
Oh, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. Dawn is coming up, you know, but the first buses haven't run yet, and all the Italians and everybody would go downstairs. We used to have that big patio that went three quarters of the way around Stones, and I always remember Tony Leo, the manager, whatever, and we'd go up there, and he used to get the fire buckets and tip them off the top, because otherwise they would sleep and make a mess and everything else, and we'd make everything all wet and slippery there, so nobody would sleep on the patios. But I mean, the crazy thing was that other than a very small criminal element in those days that used to come to the clubs openly. I mean, everybody got on with everybody else, and you didn't feel uneasy at any given time. Nowadays, I think people feel a lot more uneasy when they're around clubbing situations, because they don't know who the person is that's next to them anymore, and they don't know their intentions so much. In those days, everybody was just out to have a really good time. You went out with so many Maltese lire in your pocket, and you stayed out till you spent it, and then you found a way of getting home, and that was the living in those days. Yes, obviously there had to be drugs and things around, but it wasn't so much hard class A cocaine, heroin, whatever, so much as a few people getting high in a corner. You'd smell marijuana somewhere or whatever, you know, because the heavy drug crowd, they weren't interested in the youngsters in the discotheques, or didn't seem to be at that time, although we gradually saw that change
in the 90s
years came.
Yeah.
Unkomplu l-intervista ma' Ian James il-ġimgħa d-dieħla waqt l-edizzjoni numru 11 tal-programm Għalfejn il-lejla fuq 103.7 Campus FM. Tinsewx li episodju minn din is-sensiela qed jittellgħu fuq is-sit elettroniku ta' Campus FM biex tkunu tistgħu tisimgħuhom fil-kumdità tagħkom meta u fejn tridu.
Diggy diggy bong diggy bong. For this.